the Concordia Theological Seminary 30th Annual Symposium on the Lutheran Confessions presents the Reverend Matthew C. Harrison and his paper, Crossing Old Line Boundaries, Works of Lutheran Charity.
There is a picture from my childhood that sticks in mind as I come from a previous ecclesial affiliation. A picture from the cover of Time or Life magazine, I think, of Dr. Franklin Clark Fry, then president of the Lutheran Church in America. This picture included the caption that read, "Mr. World Lutheran." And I would suggest that the mantle once worn so proudly by Franklin Clark Fry might now adorn our next speaker. For in so many ways, he has become the international face of the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod, directing projects of mercy and human relief around the world. Indeed, the words of John Wesley, "All the world is my parish," could also be said of the Reverend Matthew Harrison. Pastor Harrison's work as a pastor in Westgate, Iowa, and then at Zion Lutheran Church here in Fort Wayne, as well as these last 6 years as executive director of Lutheran Church Missouri Synod Relief and Human Care, has been marked by deeply Lutheran theological convictions and keen ecumenical insight. He is the editor of two volumes of the works of Hermann Sasse, The Lonely Way, with a third volume, Yet on the Way. His confessional commitment, like that of Sasse, has prompted ecumenical engagement, as during his days here in Fort Wayne, Pastor Harrison was an active member of the local Lutheran Roman Catholic Dialogue Committee that brought Cardinal Cassidy to speak on this campus. He has authored numerous tracts on the theological basis for the Church's diaconal work, and I have been privileged to work with him as co-editor of a volume of essays under the title Biblical Vision, Lutheran Voices, Essays on Women's Ordination, that will be released by Concordia Publishing House later this year. And lest there be any doubt, we are against women's ordination. So, but I think you'll find those essays quite helpful in the current debate that is going on in worldwide Lutheranism. Pastor Harrison's topic this morning is Crossing Old Line Boundaries, Works of Lutheran Charity. Please join me in welcoming Pastor Matthew Harrison.
Thank you, John. John is one of those great and unique individuals who can really talk about any subject at length and usually does. Have you seen his bibliographies? I mean, even his ignorance is encyclopedic. He's one of those guys who believes in the discipline of silence and can talk for hours about it. Good day. It's great to be here. You know, Wenthy mentioned at the Circuit Counselor's Retreat some months ago that he was jogging in Texas. And he's jogging, and some younger female noticed him and gave him a little wave, a bit to his surprise. And he recounted this story. I decided to do a little historical criticism and put the question, you know, what was it, Dean, was it historical narrative? I don't think so. Was it prophetic genre? He would hope so. Was it apocalyptic, perhaps? some slight chance of that. I think really it was finally apocryphal. Now, this gave cause to play a little video that our office put together to help men just like you, good-looking men like you who travel the world and are around in all kinds of circumstances, to help you deal with challenging circumstances that could otherwise get you in trouble. Sir? There you go. Crossing Old Line Boundaries, the Works of Lutheran Charity. David Scare gave me this topic. I felt as though I were his graduate assistant again in the systematics department. There was no discussion about the topic. It just arrived. Here's your topic. I felt at once that I should react as I did often as his grad assistant. I learned quickly that if I acted on anything he said immediately, I had a whole lot of work to do, but if I just waited 24 hours, he would have forgotten it completely. But here it is. It got in print. Well, I'm going to argue that there are old line boundaries, and we should cross them, and that there should be Lutherans, and that Lutherans are involved in works of charity. Hence, there are Lutheran works of charity. My friends, this is the very moment of moments to be alive and to be a confessional Lutheran. Before I make a case for that, let's be frank. The state of world Lutheranism is deplorable. So what else is new? The latest report of the Lutheran World Federation has so many female clergy depicted in its pages that it looks like an Almy special edition catalog for women. The Church of Sweden jumped off the cliff this year past with respect to homosexuality, merely consistently following the consequences of the hermeneutics which long ago rejected the specific mandates of the Lord regarding gender. Any objective observer can see that the leadership of the ELCA is amassing its energies at the same cliff, apparently willing to risk all contact with and cooperation with the Missouri Synod. The Lutheran Church of Australia has battled for 20 years on the ordination of women and are still at a 50-50 split. The very spirit of tolerance which the great elector was already pushing 100 years before the Prussian Union, at the time of Valentin Ernst Lescher, and which was codified in the Brandenburg Prussian Church, then the largest Lutheran church in the world in 1817, has become a spirit of intolerance for what the Lutheran confessions actually mandate, and has come to completely dominate Lutheran seminaries, Lutheran faculties, Lutheran judicatories worldwide. What Luther decisively rejected in Marburg when he refused Zwingli's outstretched hand in 1529 by saying, "Vos habetis alium spiritum quam nos," you have a different spirit from us, that is fellowship with those who do not confess the body and blood of Christ in the sacrament, received orally and without respect to the faith of the individual recipient, has been accepted in the vast stretches of Lutheranism. How shocking it is still to read the 1973 statement, I just read it in the new book on Seminex by Zimmerman from CPH, how shocking it is to read that 1973 statement of students of Concordia Seminary St. Louis, supportive of the faculty majority, which notes, among many other things, that strict insistence on Lutheran doctrine, the Lutheran doctrine of the body and blood in the sacrament, should not prevent intercommunion with non-Lutheran and non-Lutheran churches. Most recently, I saw that the Lutheran Church in the Holy Land, the Church of Lebanon, a church that, while not in communion with Missouri, has had a lot of LCMS contact over the years, they adopted full communion with the Reformed. To quote Zasa from his days of intense involvement in the leadership of the Faith and Order movement, our witness was too weak. In fact, we really didn't give a witness at all. I'm amused by the otherwise wonderful Logia series, Wittenberg and Constantinople. Just as Hagia Sophia in Constantinople became a mosque and is now a museum, Wittenberg is all but dead to Luther's own confession and has been for two centuries. As Zasa quipped, Wittenberg has the smell of an empty wine cask. Something sweet was once there but is no longer present. Wittenberg has 50,000 residents. Only 5,000 register as Christians. Only a small fraction of that will go to church. The Union swallowed up Wittenberg, closed its university, and finally outlawed the observance of the confession, particularly the small called articles and the Formula of Concord. In this little town, which was once the impetus for the gospel and all its articles to be proclaimed in a way that shook the world, which boasted dozens of bookbinderies, it's now virtually impossible to find a Book of Concord. The Luther House has a Roman Catholic director. Calvin's Doctrine of the Sacrament has as much right at the church's altar as Luther's. And a preacher has as much right to teach the doctrine of the Heidelberg Catechism as that of Luther. The 19th century Lutheran revival, which gave birth to the LCMS and a revival of genuine Lutheranism around the world, never touched Wittenberg. In fact, the sister church of the church of which St. Mary's in Wittenberg is a part is not even the ELCA. It is, in fact, the UCC here in the United States. That church is a result and descendant of the American mission of the Prussian Union, namely what became the Evangelical Synod of the West. What was sought by Zwingli, Bucer, Calvin, Elizabeth I of England, the great elector, his descendant, Frederick Wilhelm III, Friedrich Schleiermacher, and forcefully and successfully by Karl Barth at Barmen during the Kirchenkampf, has been virtually completely achieved, namely the Calvinization of Lutheranism. That is, that Lutheranism is not a church, but merely a theological school, a form of piety, perhaps, within one large Protestant communion. This is the great danger of the view that Lutheranism is a confessing movement within the broader church. I believe in one holy Catholic and apostolic church. That church exists on this earth most clearly and certainly where the gospel and all its articles are preached purely and the sacraments administered according to Christ's institution, a.k.a. Lutheranism, the true visible church of God on earth. Moreover, it exists, the church exists, thank God, wherever there is enough of the gospel and the sacraments to create faith. And by the way, I heard the gospel beautifully at my own grandmother's Roman Catholic funeral last week. A homily that spoke of the resurrection, the forgiveness of sins, and grace throughout. And then negated everything with the sacrifice of the Mass. Whatever else the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod is, it is certainly a church. The IC is an adiaphron. Heck, I'm an adiaphron. Our structures and specific form of constitution and a host of other things that the Synod does are adiaphorous. They can be done in any number of ways or even not done. But the Synod as a communion of Lutheran churches is church. Zasa warned the Lutheran world about the consequences of purporting to have Lutheran and Reformed make one confession as a church over against Hitler. He warned against the United Evangelical Lutheran Church of Germany becoming formed as a part of the EKID, the Evangelical Church in Germany, the broader Protestant Union. He warned 60 years ago this year against the weak confessional commitments of the Lutheran World Federation, and he did so in the face of opposition already in the late 40s from Adel von Dumann. 60 years has proven him a prophet. it has recently been announced that the United Evangelical Lutheran Church of Germany will dissolve into EKID, the Evangelical Church in Germany. The LWF is a great purveyor of communion with the Reformed. All sorts of games are played in subjecting churches of the developing world and elsewhere to the deconfessionalized theology of the liberal North. Money for seminaries? Oh, yes, but only if women constitute a large percentage of the student populace. Scholarships? Yes, but in churches which do not ordain women, for women wanting to be pastors studying in the North and the West, and all kinds of other issues. What's at stake? If, as Luther confessed, the sacrament is the gospel, then the gospel is at stake. I challenge you to find one Lutheran theological faculty in Europe or America of an LWF church, aside from our faithful Latvian and Lithuanian partners, in which the view that there is salvation outside of Christ is not tolerated or even presupposed and dominant. Show me a faculty where the gospel is not regularly redefined in terms of political theology, theologies of liberation from oppression for not only the poor, but for women and now for homosexuals. Marquardt was right in his drumbeat against historical criticism, upon which the Union has always depended. And here I would urge you to read Robert Preuss's essays, which have recently been released from CPH. They are an absolute tour de force testimony of the incompatibility of historical criticism with confessing Lutheran dogma. And the history, particularly the recent history of the church, has proved it over and over and over again. In his drumbeat against historical criticism and against the Union, Kurt rightly recognized the Prussian Union as the black hole, as he liked to say, around which all of the Lutheran world has been circling for 200 years. Depressed yet? Don't be. And you shouldn't say, "My, the church isn't what it used to be." I've got news for you. It never was. Don't be depressed. It's never really been any different. And two, out of this abyss of difficulty is coming unprecedented opportunity for confessional Lutherans. We in Missouri have our internal struggles. They are serious and they are real. But I would recommend you read a dose of Valentin Ernst Lesher's Timotheus Varinus. Lutheranism has from the beginning struggled with the problem of authority and theological unity. But that's no problem unique to Lutheranism. The New Testament betrays the same struggles, to be sure. Zasa and Ehlert have repeatedly and richly demonstrated that there was no golden age of unity in the first centuries of the church's life. There was no ancient undivided church, and there will be no future reunited church, for that matter. Luther's life was beset with controversy within the churches of the Augsburg Confession. Brecht's magisterial volumes bear that out repeatedly. The period after Luther's death was a disaster until the Formula of Concord brought about agreement, but it didn't last long. Helmstedt, the university founded to be a bastion of orthodoxy, even boasting the strict and intense Lutheran Tilemann Hesuzius, who refused to sign the Formula of Concord for not personally condemning Philip Melanchthon by name. He was the first chancellor of Helmstedt, soon plunged the church into controversy at the instigation of that great evangelical Catholic, George Calixt, the Tom Oden of his day, over the so-called syncretistic controversy. And this at the very temporal epicenter of the age of Lutheran orthodoxy. Peruse Dedekind's Thesaurus or Zeiling's Edition of the Church Orders, and you find a Lutheran church beset with controversy, doctrinal disagreement, and problems of church practice and struggle over the limits of liturgical freedom. And all that was prior to the advent of pietism in the late 17th century. On the anniversary of the Reformation in 1717, Lesher wrote the preface to volume one of his Timotheus Varinus. Lesher begins his chapter on the general characteristics of the pietistic evil. In Latin, it's malum pietisticum, which is a great motto, by noting problems with A, public movements which harm the church. B, dangerous, annoying, and arrogant individual exploits. C, frequent and lengthy controversies carried on in public writings. D, the ever more obvious division into two or more factions. Elsewhere, Lesher complains of the, quote, contempt and disregard for divine orders, for perfectionism, or the idea that human actions can be sinless, which, quote, finally ends in fanatical independence in everything, mysticism, rigidism, excessive freedom, which breeds fanaticism and enthusiasm, confusion of theological categories. He complained about the disconnect between pulpit and SEM lecture hall and asserted that what is maintained at the academic rostrum and does not agree with the pulpit must for that reason be proclaimed as an error. Among the other pietistic evils, Lesher mentions the devaluation of the office of the ministry. The point? The church has always been tectum cruce. It has always been hidden under the cross, as Luther said. And in the midst of all this nonsense and much more outside of Lutheranism, the Lord continued and continues to work in his word and sacrament for the salvation of souls. Upon this rock I shall build my church, and the gates of hell shall not prevail against it. Now, why is this the moment for confessional Lutheranism, particularly the Missouri Synod? Here's the good news, folks. The Missouri Synod is alive and kicking, and in some ways stronger than ever. For all the weaknesses and failings of the Missouri Synod, for all her internal strife and nonsense, in spite of her near capitulation to so-called inclusive Lutheranism and union in the 60s and 70s, she's still here. Warts and all, to be sure, but she's still here. And she's confessing the Book of Concord, quia. Missouri ist unsere letzte Hoffnung, Zasa wrote to a friend. Missouri's our last hope. Her seminaries are unparalleled in the world. Travel, and you'll find that out. Her institutions have unimaginable capacity for good, for furthering the gospel and the Lutheran confession. We also have unbelievable wealth. You know, we may think of ourselves as a smaller church body, but consider this. If you visited 300 LCMS congregations a year, which would be impossible, it would take you 20 years, and you would still not be done visiting all the churches, all the congregations of this blessed church body. We have a $1 billion pension fund. We have a $1 billion extension fund. We have a Concordia University system, which, whatever its weaknesses may be, has right now arguably the finest religion faculty overall that it's had in 50 years. We sustain a $30 million a year world mission program. The past 3 years have sustained more than $20 million a year in human care endeavors of LCMS World Relief and Human Care. Our social ministry institutions touch this year 3 million people with care. Concordia Publishing House is producing, in my view, the finest and most consistently excellent material in its entire history. The new commentary series is unparalleled in biblical and confessional fidelity. We have just produced what is arguably the best new hymnal and worship books in the history of the English-speaking Lutheran world. We have access to the generous funding of the $1 billion Marvin M. Schwann Charitable Foundation, which is as orthodox as it is wealthy. Lutheran Heritage Foundation is producing catechisms and other orthodox material in so many languages that I've lost count. And many, many other strengths could be mentioned. Missouri is alive and kicking. This is a great moment to be in the Missouri Synod, in my view. All this comes at a perfect moment when the world has become a superhighway for travel and information. I was in Singapore a year or two ago, and I was in Adelaide, South Australia, and I ran into some Singapore pastors. And I was chatting with them, and there was one young man chatting with me, and this guy was one intense confessional, sacramental, and liturgical Lutheran. And I'm talking to this guy. I said, where did you get this? And he said, you know Logia Online? The fall of the Soviet Union has brought unprecedented opportunities and contacts in Eastern Europe. Latvia and Lithuania are their own extraordinary stories of contact with the Lutheran Church, Missouri Synod, and finally Fellowship. The rise of Siberian Lutheranism, the Ingrian Church, Fellowship with the Ingrian Church. This has been, in many respects, the decade of Missouri. African Lutheranism. I talked to a bishop at a Church World Service meeting in Montreux, Switzerland, some couple of years ago. Told him about the Missouri Synod, and he said, if you would have been here 10 or 15 years ago, all of Africa would have been yours. Now, he said that. I wouldn't talk in such sort of colonialistic ways. But the fact is, we have tremendous new opportunities and partners in Africa, in East Africa, the Kenyan Church, now in Fellowship, Uganda, Sudan. How in the world you build a genuine Lutheran church and human care activities under the challenges faced in Sudan is a miracle, but it's been done. Ethiopia. We have even contacts in Tanzania and many, many other places. Madagascar. In Western Africa, Liberia, Togo, Cote d'Ivoire. Our South African seminary is taking students from all over the continent and has room, or is crying out for assistance to make room for many more who want to come. The doors are open for Missouri. Asia, as a result of our own staff member, Darren Storkson's work for LCMS World Relief, we have had for the first time contact, personal contact, with all 11 LWF members in Indonesia. The largest is the Batak Church, represented here today. That church is half again as large as the Missouri Synod. And there are many in that church who are crying out for a greater definition of Lutheranism. It's challenging. We can learn from the Bataks. We can learn a great deal from the Batak Church about standing tall in challenging circumstances, facing a government that is not always favorable. And yet our brothers in the faith there stand tall for the sake of Christ and his gospel. They want Lutheranism. They want Luther's Two Kingdoms doctrine. They need it in their context. They want the Lutheran liturgy. They want Lutheran doctrine and heritage. And what this relationship is with the Batak Church, it will be determined by them. But the point is, here are two partners, the Missouri Synod and the Hakabepe, who nobody could have possibly expected would have had anything to do with each other ever. And here we're talking. We're sharing resources, etc. In South and Central America, the doors are open. The Dominican, Guatemala, we have with LCMS World Mission now deaconess training beginning in Panama, which will be an effort at a worldwide deaconess effort. Nicaragua, Venezuela. We have partner churches who are in the LWF. I do not think the Missouri Synod should join the LWF. However, it's great to have friends there who bear witness. We have now purchased property with Zelk in Wittenberg, not 20 yards from the front door of St. Mary's Church. And we hope that this tool, under the direction of Willem Torgerson and Zelk, will become a tool also for worldwide Lutheranism and rallying point for the Lutheran faith. Now is Missouri's moment. We ought to have contacts with every Lutheran church in the world, particularly in the developing world. We ought to have redoubled contacts with every Lutheran church in the world which does not ordain women. Sam Nasker asked me, and I think quite legitimately, how would you feel if the LWF sent people to Florida to promote the ordination of women? I'd say, I've thought about this, let them come. We can handle it. Let's say it's an open door policy. The truth can stand the light of day. Let's confess. Let's open the door. We could then open it up in Central Illinois, maybe. We have a vote on that. there has been a revolution at LCMS World Relief and Human Care, pushing the boundaries, and it has been a change for the sake of the gospel and the confession. Let me tell you how International Lutheran Relief has worked. The Missouri Synod has had a long and positive relationship with Lutheran World Relief Baltimore, and we have over the years given probably tens of millions of dollars to that entity based in Baltimore. It is a board made up two-thirds of ELCA people, one-third LCMS. The dollars for LWR institutionally come from our shop, LCMS World Relief, from the donors to LCMS World Relief. When a disaster strikes, or there are development needs around the world, LWR, which is a fine development and relief agency, goes to the local circumstance and finds local partners, which are the local non-governmental organizations. Those organizations may be Lutheran. I mean, they almost certainly are never Lutheran. They may be faith-based in some sense. They may be secular. They may be a coalition of other partners. They may be part of sort of the large ecumenical group act, etc. But what does not generally happen is relief is not directed to or is capacity built for specific Lutheran partners. That is, for Lutheran congregations, Lutheran judicatories, Lutheran churches on the ground in the circumstance. So in the past, when tsunami struck several years ago, in the past, we would have just sent our money to Baltimore, and that would have gone to the region to be doled out, and responsibly so, to the number of non-governmental organizations distributing relief and aid. It's effective, it's good work, etc. On the other hand, it is not connected with the gospel, and it does not build the capacity of Lutherans or the Lutheran Church. We resolved in this last disaster to start spending money in a way that increased the capacity of Lutherans. And by doing so, which is difficult work, by doing so, to build their capacity both to care for people in need and to bear witness to Christ in the process. And to advance the cause of the Lutheran Church in good and positive ways. That has been a huge sea change. A similar sea change took place with respect to Katrina. In the past, we would have sent money to Chicago, to the ELCA, to be administered by Lutheran Disaster Response, ELCA personnel, a cooperative venture between Missouri and the ELCA, doled out in large measure through the social ministry agencies, which have done an absolutely fantastic job reaching the broader community. But those dollars would not have gone to LCMS congregations, the LCMS district, LCMS people specifically who needed help. Some people have criticized this and said, well, by doing this, you are just serving your own. The fact is, when our own are hit, they say, give me what I need, I'm here, now send some more so I can help all these other people around me. And as they do so, they do in the name of Christ and in his blessed gospel. That has been a radical sea change, and it is the change has caused some criticism, but I have no question that it was the right thing to do. That has been an old line boundary which we have crossed. As we go on to human care specifically, I was on the road to Marsabit in northern Kenya this past summer, and we had developed a leak in a tire, had the tire repaired in this African village. I noticed a rather unorthodox method of using a tire iron by the guy who was fixing the tire. We threw the tire back on the vehicle, and actually the tire repaired was thrown on the back of the vehicle, and we headed off south down the road. Now, Marsabit is an oasis in the middle of an intense desert. The heat rose tremendously over the next few hours, and as we were driving over a bridge, all of a sudden I heard kaboom! It was like I turned to my compatriot, one of the Kenyan Lutherans. I looked like one of those sea lions in SeaWorld, like this, and the truck's still rolling along. We stopped, got out, and here the spare tire had blown out on the back of the vehicle. That was a first. It looked like you had shot it with a shotgun. And at just that moment, this old Samburu man came by, a native man, Samburu man, walking by with a cane, and he's chattering in Samburu. And then he said in English, "Very funny, very funny." Well, we moved from there on down to, after three more flat tires that day, we were in a city. We pulled up, as is the case in many places in Africa, you pull up and here are all these children affected by AIDS. They are AIDS orphans. Their parents are dead. And East Africans, Kenyans by nature, are very humble people. You respect the elderly. There's a very calm, low-key demeanor. People do not raise their voice, but yet these children are totally opposite, doing all kinds of antics and horsing around, trying to get attention, some of them addicted, etc. And what is it? I tell you, it's because of the most fundamental need of all of humanity, that is, to be accounted as somebody, to be recognized. Here are young people who have been completely rendered as non-humans by their community. They do not exist. We helped build an orphanage last year, and after a little boy gave me a tour of the place, a 12-year-old boy, he said to me the most profound thing I ever heard. He said, I asked him, "What do you think?" And he said, "I thank God and Jesus Christ that somebody has regarded us as human beings." My friends, the doctrine of justification is the answer to life's persistent questions. The doctrine of justification by grace for Christ's sake through faith has something to say about being human. The doctrine of justification is the heart and soul, the sine qua non of non-Lutheranism, not only of Lutheranism, but more than that, the sine qua non of Christianity. It is pure gift on the one hand, and bearing witness to it, sola gratia, sola fide, solus Christus, is far and away our chief ecumenical task. The task of the Lutheran Church is to be Lutheran. In his Locus on Justification, Johann Gerhard wrote, "Biblia ita legenda esse acce saquina Christi per totum esse scriptura." He says, the Bible is to be read as though every letter were written with the ink of the blood of Christ. And I tell you, that ink from the blood of Christ dripped off Melanchthon's pen when he wrote these words. "It is taught among us that we cannot obtain forgiveness of sin and forgiveness before God by our own merits, works, or satisfactions, but that we receive forgiveness of sin and become righteous before God by grace, for Christ's sake, through faith, when we believe that Christ suffered for us, and that for his sake our sin is forgiven, and righteousness and eternal life are given to us. For God will regard and reckon this faith as righteousness, as Paul says in Romans 3 and 4. As Luther stated in the Small Call articles, nothing in this article can be given up or compromised, even if heaven and earth and things temporal should be destroyed. On this article rests all that we teach and practice against the Pope, the devil, and the world. This faith is held, reckoned, imputed, halten, zu rechnen, imputat, for righteousness. We are justified, coram Deo, not by our own powers or merits, but we are justified propter Christum per fidem." Can this dogma have any meaning today? Oswald Bayer writes something terribly profound, and it's profound for works of Lutheran charity. The doctrine of justification is, in fact, the center of all Lutheran works of charity, because the doctrine of justification says something about being human. It says something about the fundamental need to be recognized, to be accounted, to be recognized as a person. "There is no escaping," says Bayer, "the questions and evaluations of others. If one accepts and welcomes the other or not, if one greets the other or not, if one acknowledges the other, either through praise or reproach, affirmation or negation, or if one does not acknowledge the other and regards the other as worthless, a decision is made concerning our being or non-being. Only a being that is recognized and acknowledged is a being that is alive. If no one were to call and greet me by name, if no one were ready to speak to me and look at me, then I would be socially non-existent. I would even be physically non-existent. I would have no life at all if my parents had not acknowledged me and respected my life even before my birth. I would no longer have any life if after my birth my parents had not smiled at me and talked to me, thus opening a space for community, accepting and acknowledging me. An unwanted child is aware of this rejection. The denial of unconditional and anticipated recognition, the denial of love, shows how necessary recognition is. Its denial is a painful and especially impressive indication of its necessity for life. And Beyer goes on to argue that basically all reality is involved with the justification debate. All reality. And I would hold that this doctrine of justification causes us then to recognize all as worthy of Christ's blood, of righteousness for Christ's sake, and then also our care. I'm going to have to cut it a bit short. Let me just say this by way of the final section. In our circles, for some reason, in the last 40, 50 years especially, we have allowed the government to take over care for the poor and needy, and simply, as the welfare state has arisen, simply said that the responsibility for care for the needy is not really a Lutheran task. That the Lutheran task is finally simply to preach the gospel and administer the sacraments. Well, that is certainly our fundamental sine qua non task. Nevertheless, the New Testament and the Lutheran confessions and our fathers bear witness to the responsibility of the church to be involved in Lutheran works of charity. And I tell you, when you go to somebody and proclaim the gospel, if you turn away from that person's need by refusing to acknowledge that person as a valuable human being, that most fundamental need, you in a way render the gospel impotent. Christ combines speaking and acts of mercy throughout the Gospels. The early church combined speaking the gospel with acts of mercy throughout. If you have any doubt, and you shouldn't have, take a look at Paul's collection for Jerusalem. The entire sub-theme of the book of Acts is the fact that Paul saw a tremendous need in Jerusalem and spent a good 10 to 15 years of his life organizing a collection for the poor. All the stewardship passages of 2 Corinthians 8 and 9, God loves a cheerful giver. He who sows sparingly shall reap sparingly, etc. All of them. The gift is acceptable not according to what one has, but according to what one does not have. All of those passages have to do with Paul collecting dollars for the church in Jerusalem. And Paul does this as an expression of koinonia, fellowship. We have tended in the Missouri Synod to define fellowship as agreement in dogma, period. For Luther, it is much more dynamic. It is certainly that, as it is for the New Testament. In fact, Paul even calls the collection a koinonia and a liturgia and a diaconia in 2 Corinthians. Luther said in 1519 on the Sacrament of the Altar, when you go to the rail or I go to the rail, we lay down our burdens upon Christ in the sacrament and upon the community, and at the same time, we pick up the burdens of the community when we return. Fellowship for the New Testament is not merely, it certainly is, unity in dogma and teaching, but as the Small Call articles say in 249, it is unity in faith, doctrine, sacraments, and opera caritatis, works of love. Works of love are an indication of koinonia. My dear friends, our fathers taught this regularly. I don't have time to go into those now. I will cease. There are, in fact, old boundaries. The boundaries need to be crossed. The moment is challenging for Lutheranism, but it's a moment of unprecedented opportunity. Let's cross the boundaries, and let's act with charity, speaking the gospel clearly, being Lutherans, and loving people in need. Thank you.